Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt, and welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? I'd like to start off by welcoming all of the new listeners that we've gained over the last month or so. A lot of new downloads coming in, and it's very exciting, so welcome. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Today's podcast is something I haven't done in a while. This is going to be a hiking podcast. I know the videos over on YouTube have kind of taken over that role, but today this is simply audio from a trip I recently took with my partner in crime, the wonderful and just fantastic travel partner, Sarah Johnson. We were recently in the Sonoran Desert. It was my first time in the desert Southwest. I have never truly experienced a real desert before, and it was incredible. I had a blast, and I really get the appeal now. I get it. I think the most amazing thing for me, at least, was the fact that, you know, other than a handful of Opuntia species and a mammillaria or two, I have not really seen cacti in the wild before, especially not in any great scale. So to land in Arizona, get off the plane, walk out into the desert, and see towering saguaros, tons of different echinoceras, it was so cool to see these plants that are normally disembodied in pots growing in situ in the wild as they evolve to grow. Now, the Sonoran Desert is kind of weird. It's a green desert, they kept saying, because it gets two rainy seasons a year. Generally, they get rain in spring and then rain again in mid-summer-ish, thanks to the monsoons. Now, by the time we had gotten there, the spring was a little bit dry, but nonetheless, they had had some rain, so we were seeing things like ocotillo in bloom. Some of the cacti were starting to bloom. We didn't see a lot of the desert annuals, but there were enough plants on the landscape to not make it overwhelming. Honestly, I think if they were all in bloom, I would have just been beside myself. But at least this was a manageable introduction to the desert ecosystem, and it was so much fun. Aside from plants, we saw a ton of wildlife, and that was pretty cool. I did not expect the desert to feel as just diverse as it was and so alive. And I think deserts get the short shrift. I know when I teach students, for instance, we talk about biodiversity, and they always talk about the rainforest being the most important place to protect. And indeed, I don't disagree with that. It is super important to protect. But the way they talk about biodiversity makes it feel like you just should always go with the more biodiverse ecosystem. And the argument I always make is, despite not having raw numbers like a rainforest ecosystem or even a temperate forested ecosystem, I feel like the desert should be just as intrinsically valuable to protect, even though its biodiversity numbers are slightly lower than most habitats. So we saw lots of really cool birds. One of the really neat things about the Sonoran Desert, at least where we were on the border, essentially, of Mexico, is that it's one of the few places in the continental United States that you will see certain species come up with their range. Like, there's plenty of bird species. Like, we saw the golden-eyed junco. That's a predominantly Mexican species. We saw the painted redstart, I believe, which is predominantly a Mexican species. There was lots of these birds called the Phainopepala, I think they're called. They look like an all-black cedar waxwing with red eyes, and they were everywhere. They were really neat to see. The Gila woodpeckers were awesome because they were nesting inside a lot of the saguaros, making a lot of noise. I adore woodpeckers as the ecosystem engineers that they are. And of course, their burrows, or I guess nest cavities, provide plenty of homes for other animals. And I think one of the pinnacle of my desert experience over the last week was finally getting to see a Gila monster. I've always wanted to see one of these reptiles since I was a little kid. And one day we were walking down the trail and we heard a noise and it sounded strange. So I kind of peeked over to where it was coming from and I saw a large rabbit run away. And I said, huh, that's weird. I only know rabbits to make noise when they're being attacked. So I kind of peeked over the shrubs a little bit further and lo and behold, there was a Gila monster eating some baby rabbits. It was phenomenal. You know, Gila monsters get a bad rap. Obviously, they're a predator. They're a venomous reptile, but they're generally not aggressive. But sadly, due to habitat destruction and wanton just killing by citizens because they fear them, they're considered vulnerable or at risk of becoming endangered. So to see one actively hunting and eating was, I think, one of those once-in-a-lifetime experiences that we are so fortunate that we got to see. You won't hear any of that today, but This episode in particular is, we were on a mission, and this is one that I give credit to my good friend, botanist Paul Markham, who has been on this podcast before. He gave us this quote-unquote assignment, and it was really fun to do. I was really happy to do this because it involved going to find a handful of cacti species that I had no prior experience with. So one of the hikes that we did was through a national monument called Organ Pipe National Monument, and it's right on the Mexican border. And again, just like the birds we were talking about, this is one of the few spaces in the United States where a handful of plants from Mexico make their way into the U.S. Of course, plants do not follow political boundaries. That's not what this is about. But we were at the very northern edge of their range, and we'll describe why that is during the episode. But we were going in search of the saguaro cactus, the organ pipe cactus, and the sanita cactus. Now, these are three columnar cacti, so they form those large stems. The saguaro can reach heights of 40 to 50 feet, no problem. The organ pipe and the sanita are a little bit smaller, but they're still incredibly impressive because, unlike the saguaro, which has one main stem and a handful of arms, both the sanita and the organ pipe are multiple-stemmed cacti that are just phenomenal. It was so cool to see these. So this is a matter of, did we see them? I think if you follow me on any of the other social media sites, you'll know the answer to that. But we see a lot of amazing plants along the way. I think my favorites personally outside of the cacti were definitely the creosote bush. That was just a desert rock star. We'll talk about that. The Palo Verde tree, which I learned a lot about this week because I wrote a post about it. You can go see that in defensiveplants.com on the blog. And this species is leguminous, and I don't talk about this in there, so I don't mind ruining a little bit of the surprise, but it has bark photosynthesis. The whole tree is just this emerald green color, and it stands out against the sort of reds and browns of the desert. It is just a stunning tree to come across. It's multi-stemmed. They form these kind of brushy thickets, and all the branches seem to taper to sharp little points. It's well adapted to desert life. And it generally doesn't produce leaves very often. It does so when the rains are around, and the leaves are these small little like pinnate versions of what you would see on something like a honey locust, just extremely tiny. And majority of its photosynthetic needs are met through photosynthesis that's done underneath the bark and the stems. And that's really cool. Shout out to Ben for emailing me about this. And Ben asked, it's really cool that they're doing this stem photosynthesis, but how do they regulate gas exchange? The crux of photosynthesis is getting CO2 into the cellular spaces so that they can then break apart those carbons and use them to fix into sugars to live. And that requires diffusion. And in leaves, there's stomates, these little pores on the surface of the leaves that allow interchange of gas and water vapor. But without leaves, how does that happen? And I'm not sure if the Palo Verde has lots of lenticels that look like they might, which are pores in the bark. But even so, I don't think lenticels have enough surface area to provide enough gas exchange for photosynthesis to keep a tree alive. So I hit the literature and I found out that the Palo Verde actually is able to recycle CO2 that it produces during the respiration process. Now, I know this is probably review for some of you, but essentially, plants go through photosynthesis. They take CO2 and water and they make sugars that they can then use to fuel their metabolism. But the second half of that part of the fueling the metabolism is digesting and breaking down those sugars to use to build structures. And in the process, just like you and I break down foods and make CO2, the plants do as well. So what the Palo Verde and others that go through stem photosynthesis do is they're able to recycle that internal CO2 to photosynthesize. It's almost like a perpetual motion machine, although it's not. Obviously, there's inputs from a star billions of miles away in space, but wow, that is such a cool metabolism. They're able to get enough sun throughout the year just hitting on their stems and then recycle all of that waste CO2 inside of their system to keep them fueled even when they don't have leaves. And what's more incredible is it helps them reduce water loss. Leaves are the number one way that plants lose water to the environment because of evapotranspiration. And by never really having to grow leaves unless there's lots of moisture on the landscape, the Palo Verde has great water use efficiency in an arid environment for a C3 plant. So that's the most common photosynthetic pathway, which generally doesn't perform as well in arid environments as something like a CAM plant, crassuleic acid metabolism, or a C4 plant, which is like a lot of warm season grasses, and even some species like purslane. So that was just such a cool learning experience, and I really thank Ben for emailing me that. That's why I love interacting with everyone. I get so many good questions and I get to learn from them. So thank you, Ben. All right, I think I've talked enough, but before we get into the meat of the hiking episode, I just have one thing I want to talk about here, and that's supporting this podcast. If you're enjoying it and you would like to help In Defense of Plants continue to put out quality content, please head on over to patreon.com/indefenseofplants and see what's going on over there. Patreon is the way in which I keep In Defense of Plants up and running. I don't have ads, I don't belong to a media company, so I rely on you, the listener, to help keep the lights on. Podcasting gets a little pricey. I gotta host the website, I have to buy equipment, and I travel every once in a while, which I do have an announcement on that, which I'll announce at the end of the show, which you have helped me on. But Patreon is a great way to crowdsource funds. So if you enjoy this podcast and you want to put some money on it, go check it out. It's a little bit each month. You can put as little as a dollar or as much as $10, and you get kickbacks in return. So one of the kickbacks is a sticker. You get that lovely In Defense of Plants sticker. Thank you. You can also get access to this VIP section on the indefenseofplants.com website, where every once in a while I just photo dump or I put on really cool audio files that I recorded. Gonna have some really good stuff for you in the next couple of weeks, so that's one to keep your eye on. And for those reaching the top tier, which is $10 a month, you can get a producer credit on this show. For instance, today's episode is produced in part by Clifton, Letitia, Ron, Carl, Tim, Lisa, Susanna, Homestead Brooklyn, Daniela, Brody, Kevin, Sophia, Plant by Design, Mark, Katharina, Sammy and Sven, Renz, Bendix, Erene, Holly, Mountain Misery Farms, Caitlin, Rosanna, Mary Jane, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, and Margie. So thank you to everyone who has given this far. It really does help. It's going such a long way in keeping In Defense of Plants more interesting for you. Stay tuned at the end of the show. I'll give you the big announcement that I've been hinting at, which, again, is due in part to all of your support. If multiple donations a year are not your thing, you can give a one-time lump sum amount of any amount. Just head on over to indefenseofplants.com, scroll down on the right-hand side of the page, and hit that donate button. All right, so what you're about to hear is a bunch of segments that we recorded during a hike in the Sonoran Desert down near the Mexican border in search of the three columnar cacti that you can see in the Sonoran Desert. It was really fun. I think there is one error that I have to correct. What we thought was the desert caper turned out to be a species of Lycium. Lycium might sound familiar because it's the genus that gives us goji berries, but there are plenty of relatives of this. These were large, spiky, solanaceous shrubs with these beautiful, sort of purplish lavender flowers. So when you hear us say desert caper, what we really mean is Lycium. But otherwise, I hope you enjoy this episode. It's the wonderful sounds of the desert and a lot of really cool plant facts along the way. I hope you enjoy. Hey, Sarah Johnson.
Hello, Matt Candeas.
Where are we right now?
We are in Oregon Pipe National Monument.
In the Sonoran Desert of Arizona.
Hot.
It is hot, but not as hot as I was expecting it to be. This is your first desert experience, right?
It's my first desert experience ever. I've never seen a cactus growing in the wild except for the prickly pear at Sand Ridge Prairie in Illinois.
That's true. The only cacti I've ever seen in the wild was one species of Mammillaria and a couple species of Opuntia, so prickly pears. But today, as we're doing this intro, I'm not only looking at tons of saguaro cacti, we've got some teddy bear cholla to our right here that look incredible with the morning sun, and
Palo Verde, lots of Palo Verde.
Yes, lots of Palo Verde. Now, Palo Verde is cool. I just learned about this. It's a legume, and it's got photosynthetic bark tissue. So every branch, every stem is green, hence Palo Verde. And it's a beautiful, beautiful tree, and they're some of the largest trees, tree-like plants we're seeing, although I'd call these more shrubby at this point. A few have leaves on them, tiny pinnate, leguminous leaves, but it's beautiful. So we're out here exploring the Sonoran Desert. We're right on the border with Mexico right now, so this is the closest I've ever been to Mexico.
Yeah, we are actual steps away from the border.
Yeah. And today we're looking for the perfect trifecta. I heard rumors that there's the perfect trifecta. And the perfect trifecta is within one photographic location, you can see a saguaro cactus, an organ pipe cactus, and a sonita cactus.
All columnar cacti species.
Yes, tall, column-like cacti. Now, the reason the other two are special, the organ pipe and the sonita. Oh, hey, a moth just landed on me.
Hey.
He likes my salt. The reason they're so special is that they're largely Sonoran Mexican species. They barely make it up into the United States due to frost tolerance. It gets a little too cold in Arizona for them. But down here, right on the border, in Oregon Pipe, you can see them in the U.S., and that's very special. So with any luck, we will be seeing them. Although, I can tell you right now, up on the Hill Ridge, I already see some Oregon Pipes. Now, the Oregon Pipe and the sonita differ from the saguaro cactus in that the saguaro is generally one single column, and if it's old enough, how old did you say before they grow arms?
90 years old.
90 years or more.
And 65 before they flower, typically.
Right. So these are large, long-lived cacti. And the saguaro, like I said, it's usually one column, and the older ones will have the arms on them, the typical arms that you see. But the sonita and the organ pipe are multiple columns generated from a one central location. So it looks like a bunch of fingers coming out of the ground, spiky fingers. Now, the organ pipe has multiple ribs all around and lots of spines. And the sonita has fewer ribs, so it's more of a chunky looking rib. And the tips of them tend to have shaggier looking spines. So they're easy enough to tell apart, probably up close. But we'll see later on if we can find them, what luck we'll have. So let's head on out into the desert, huh?
Let's do it.
Very exciting sighting. We're gonna head over there and take a gander at it. But we're looking at a whole bunch of giant saguaros right now, all of which have arms. And as Sarah mentioned earlier, the arms do not come until they're estimated to be about 70 to 90 years old. What did you say? They can't really age the cacti, right?
Well, they don't have rings like a tree.
Exactly.
So they can't age them. However, the arms are a good indicator of age. And also, we're down in a lower area. And the areas that tend to collect water or are in wash areas where flash floods happen, they're more likely to actually get...
Oh, almost.
they get more arms, of course, because they have more water resources than the ones that would be up higher.
That makes sense. Sarah, look at this. Beautiful sighting right here. We've got a little hedgehog cactus in bloom. Wow. Talk about disproportionate beauty to size. This cactus is standing at about 5 inches tall, and it's got flowers that are probably 4 inches in diameter. Amazing. We're going to stop and take some pictures. Excellent. Fine, though. Wow. These pink flowers really probably capture the attention of whatever pollinator might be out here. And again, it's just so funny to see such a large flower coming off of a cactus that's standing about 5 inches tall.
Yeah, it's definitely half the size of the plant.
Yeah. So something's going on interesting with a lot of the cacti around here. There's some great interactions with bats and birds, right?
There are. So the saguaro provides a lot of different resources. After it flowers in the May-June time of year, provides one of the only nectar sources in the driest part of the year, and then it fruits, and those fruit produce obviously a lot of food for many different animals, especially birds. And then they will travel taking that fruit with them, pooping out the seeds. Most importantly, the birds will perch on trees like the Palo Verde or another large shrubby type of plant, and they will poop out those seeds in a perfect spot for the saguaro, which needs a kind of a nursing plant.
They're called nurse plants.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, germinating or growing, even for a cactus, is pretty difficult in one of the driest habitats in the world.
Even if you love the sun. Those little baby cacti need a little bit of a...
So those nurse trees give just enough shade, provide just enough moisture that they can get through their first few years. But eventually, that can come back to haunt the nurse plant, because as the cacti get older, they can store and take up a lot more water. So it's a good relationship at first, and then can be kind of detrimental to the nurse plant overall. But That's the dynamics of this ecosystem.
Well, and they provide
wow.
a great home, too, of course, for especially woodpeckers, like the Gila woodpecker. But a lot of different animals will use the inside of the cacti.
But who pollinates those flowers? Someone else pollinates them.
The saguaro?
Yeah.
Bats?
Yeah.
Lesser long-tongued bats? Or lesser long-nosed bats, I believe.
So without bats, I don't know if we'd see so many cacti.
It's even more important for Oregon pipe, too. I think they're one of the only pollinators of the
awesome.
Oregon pipe cacti.
Okay, this is cool. This is the biggest one I've seen yet. We've got a flowering brittle brush. Brittle bush? Brittle brush? I don't know what it's called, technically. But it's a member of the Asteraceae family. It is woody. This one's huge. But I like it because not only does it have these gorgeous yellow flowers that stick up really tall, it's got these very mulliny-feeling leaves. Again, these adaptations for dry conditions.
And it's very dry.
It is very dry. In fact, the leaves are even starting to curl on this one. This is huge, though. This is a giant bush, standing probably about 4 feet tall. I didn't know they got this big. So we're walking along this trail, and I'm seeing some old friends, like saltbrush, something I haven't seen since my days in Wyoming. I believe it's Chenopodiaceae. Very small clusters of tiny, thick leaves that take on a salty-like taste, because I do think it hyperaccumulates salts from the soil. And right underneath it is this beautiful little purplish lavender aster. No idea what species it is, and I did not bring a good enough key or field guide, shame on me, to identify it in the field, so we're going to have to come back to you on that one. And then there's this strange yellow, leguminous-looking thing that gets these tiny little pods. But trifoliate leaves, yellow flowers, although not the typical keeled look. They're more open, kind of like a senna flower or something like that in form. And then right over there is another of the hedgehog cactus.
This has actually a...
Yeah?
Really solanaceous smell?
Oh, yeah, it does.
Yeah, I just...
Ooh, rubbery. Almost smells like burnt rubber.
I thought these were seeds. Are these underdeveloped seeds?
I took pictures
seeds?
Of it. Could be. Interesting finds. All right, we got ourselves down into a wetter area here. I believe there's a spring coming up, and there's some sort of spiny shrub with thick, club-looking leaves and red berries on it. No idea what that is. That's gonna be a common theme today. Kinda kicking myself for not getting the right guides before coming out here, but you know, I'm poor, so.
So we are at a spot along this stretch of Oregon pipe called Quito Baquito Springs.
Whoa, look at that mistletoe. Holy cow.
Huge mistletoe.
A mistletoe in what looks like some sort of acacia, spiny acacia. It is huge. Just a giant drapery of mistletoe. I don't know which species of mistletoe would be native here. Let's go have a look at it. Oh yeah. Now I'm not sure if it's flowering at this point, although it does seem to be getting a lot of pollinator attention. And oh yeah, look at this. Awesome. Now, it must have flowered a while ago, or at least these are recent seeds, but as with most mistletoes, birds disperse the berries, and the berries have a sticky coating around them even after they pass through the gut of a bird, and then the bird kind of wipes its behind on a branch to get them off, and the seeds then are stuck on the branch where they can then germinate, grow into the cells of the host, and start living their lives that way. Now, it doesn't look like this mistletoe has any leaves on it whatsoever. And it's kind of orange in color. Oh, yeah, it's flowering. Okay. Yeah, that is a little flower. Neat.
Living that sweet, sweet parasitic lifestyle.
Yeah. Man, I love mistletoes, personally. Oh, I'm getting stuck in these thorns. Ow.
I just heard a flunk. Also,
oh, yeah, look,
there's a
body of water over here.
I'm very excited.
All right, we're going to... be very quiet. We're gonna sneak up there. We'll update you in a little bit. All right, we found the spring,
It's the only standing water we've seen since we arrived here. And what are you seeing out there? There's some waterfowl.
Waterfowl. There's a few. There's a group of common redheads, pretty sure is
what
they
are. Those are ducks, apparently.
I don't know. They could be cinnamon teals. I don't have my book, I don't think.
Sorry, this isn't a bird podcast.
But they're either cinnamon teals or redheads. They look more like cinnamon teals, which if that's the case, that would be great because I've never seen one. And we also have some coots, American coots that are bobbing around. Very cool birds. They're fighting all the other birds off. But I expect there's probably some marsh wrens.
And I've even seen a few desert pupfish.
One of the most endangered species out here in the Sonoran area.
And then to my right here, I'm going to embarrass myself even more by not knowing what I'm talking about. It looks like a willow tree, although it's not. Although this could be... No. So it looks like a willow. It's kind of small and shrubby, woody-ish stem. And then at the tips with these lancelet toothed leaves, at the tips of the branches are seed heads, spent seed heads, that kind of remind me of something in the aster family. Don't know what that is. And then, of course, there's more of this barberry-looking stuff. Thick, succulent leaves, striped stem, kind of thorny, red berries.
Now, this spot is supposed to be one of the only places to spot the desert caper.
Desert caper. Is that what we're looking at?
Which could be.
Is that what it is?
I didn't look at it beforehand, so I don't know.
Could this be the desert caper? I think it is, Sarah.
I think it is because it has some small green fruits, which look very similar to what I would expect a caper to look like.
I thought capers were undeveloped flowers. I think I just learned that. They're not. I thought capers were just tiny olives.
You know better than me. Capers are not olives, though.
I know. I was wrong completely. You know, you just start assuming these things.
Now this plant here, which is obviously an aster of some sort, has really, really aromatic leaves, and they're very waxy, sticky, resinous.
Very resinous smell. I don't even know what I compare that to.
It smells really good. It's very
varnishy,
similar to, yeah.
Like walking into your grandparents' wood shop. Oh, hey, look, it's flowering. Look at that flower. It's purple, tubular. 5 petals fused. Okay, this is not the aster we were talking about. This is this smaller barberry looking thing. I'm going to take pictures of it. Here's another old friend I haven't seen in a while. The scarlet globe mallow. A gorgeous member of the mallow family. That has sort of orangey red flowers to it. It's in full bloom right here. And these 3-lobed... Although they've got very wrinkly edges, hairy, coarse textured leaves. I saw this a lot when I was working in Wyoming, and it's not an eastern species, so I don't see it anymore. But I think my favorite aspect about the scarlet globe mallow are its seeds. And if you've ever had one of those orange chocolate oranges that you have to smash and it breaks apart like an orange does, that's what the seed pods do. It brings me lots of joy. And I think Sarah updated, those are teal that we saw, not red-headed ducks. This is a really cool ecosystem here. You know, not a lot of water in the desert. So wherever there is water, you're going to get a lot of activity. And certainly, we're getting a lot of activity. Right on the other side of the bank, too, looks like some cottonwoods. And where there's cottonwoods, there is water. Now we're watching right now a Wilson's warbler.
Pretty sure.
Pretty sure it's a Wilson's warbler. Yellow with a black crest on its head. Eating mistletoe berries. Doing ecology right before our eyes.
I know. I just said to Matt, I hope it wipes its butt on the branch.
Yeah, Sarah wants to see the full completion of
that
life cycle.
I want to have the whole experience.
We're in a very thick, scrubby area. Right behind the spring, obviously there's a water table here, supporting a lot more vegetation, a lot more broad, quote-unquote broadleaf vegetation. I wouldn't really call this broadleaf. I'm just amazed at how well adapted everything is. And I guess overall this has been a dry spring. So things aren't as verdant as they could be, but oh, there it is. Wow, beautiful bird. Excellent find. It's so nice to see it doing ecology. Walking by some of these rushes here, and I notice there's something vining all around them that isn't a mistletoe. Got up and close with it, saw that the vine has opposite narrow leaves. This is the narrow-leafed vining milkweed. When it flowers, it kind of reminds me of a Hoya. Mm-hmm. Not as succulent, obviously, but nonetheless, beautiful umbel of purplish-pink flowers with that white-fused, I guess, column in the center. I'm blanking on the technical term for the milkweed flower anatomy, but regardless, this is neat, and it seems to be doing pretty well here next to this little spring. Looks like, besides the narrow leaves, the stems, they're pretty green and photosynthetic, so it's doing really well right here. Become quite obsessed with various Asclepiad relatives, so seeing this is pretty exciting, to say the least. And the flowers, I don't know if I mentioned this, are quite fragrant. I find it to be rather pleasant. So I gotta say, I think the real rock star of this area we've been botanizing lately is the creosote bush. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool plant.
It's kind of scraggly, shrubby, although I've seen some large ones. Beautiful yellow flowers when they are flowering, and the leaves are tiny, but they fold up on themselves, and when you unfold them, they kind of have this fishtail appearance, which I find kind of endearing. But you noticed it yesterday, and when we kind of confirmed it reading, that they're covered in like a waxy substance, right?
Yeah, they have like a resinous, waxy coating on the leaves.
And that, I guess, is to help prevent water loss and heat stress, and just really primes them for this desert habitat. But
sure, it's also anti-herbivory as well, because it probably doesn't taste very good.
No, they definitely have an odor to them, and most things that I associate with odors usually secondary metabolites to avoid herbivory as well. But what blew my mind last night is that we learned that creosote are some of the oldest, or can be some of the oldest lived organisms on the planet. There's one, I guess, in the
California
that's estimated at like 11,000 years old. Mm-hmm. It's clonal. Hey, look, and I'll punch you. Nice. It's clonal. So what ends up happening is the main stem dies, but it throws out rhizomes that go through the soil and keep popping up and can keep going and going and going. And the roots are favorite burrowing spots of things like pack rats, and I'm sure anything else that uses pack rat burrows.
Kit foxes
too. How awesome is that?
Most places in the desert don't have a lot of structure underground, and so having the root area of plants provides a good supportive place to build it in.
I love it. And it's everywhere. I mean, it really is kind of seems like the backbone of the flora of this region, aside from the cacti, of course. And it's a new one for me. I've never seen it before. It's a pretty exciting thing to be meeting all these new plants.
Now, the area we're walking right now is stupid gorgeous.
Stupid gorgeous. You like that? It is. It's
quite
amazing.
Literally, there's a ravine down to our right.
We've just stumbled across our first wild agave. Incredible. Very spiny. I'm not sure what species this is, but it does have those bud compression marks on it where you can see the outlines of the leaves that it was pressed up against. And all around me here, I'm seeing signs of old flowering stalks. Plenty of reproduction in this population. Gotta admit, I'm a little surprised. I mean, I know there's succulents, but this is pretty craggly habitat, is it not?
Very much. A lot of cool lichen.
Yes, incredible lichen and moss diversity. The moss, of course, is all shriveled and waiting for rain.
There was a resurrection fern.
Yeah, we're seeing some old ferns. Just the lichen color, though. Oof. It's a tapestry in and of itself.
This agave over here is dead, but its pup is off to the left of it.
Yeah, look at that. Oh, that's cool. So, agave and aloe look a lot alike, but whereas aloe can flower year after year after year, agaves flower once, and then they die. And then they can also set off little vegetative pups, they call them, and that's what we're looking at right here is an agave, a dead agave, adult, with an old flower stalk, and a tiny little pup off to the side. Pretty cool. Ooh, a barrel cactus. Is that what they call the fish hook barrel cactus?
Which one?
Right over here.
Yes.
Yeah, it gets that name because its larger spines curve like a fish hook. Huge, too. Would make a good seat if it wasn't for all of those spikes. Well, everyone, we did it. We saw the trifecta. We saw, together, in one shot, a saguaro,
Oregon pipe,
and a sonita, all in one, without having to go to Mexico. Albeit, we were staring pretty much right at the border at that point. But that's incredible. And again, the reason they barely make it into the United States, except for this little corner of Arizona, is due to frost tolerance. It simply just gets too cold any farther north than this. And even here, in fact, we saw a couple sonita, but in terms of seeing the trifecta, some of those sonitas looked damaged from frost, their tips. It's remarkable. This is easily one of the most unique habitats I've ever seen. How about you?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the just all of it is very, very different from the pastel colors to, you know, even in a lot of places, I guess I expected it to look less lush than it does. And it's actually very green. And even what's not blooming or what's not very, very healthy looking, you know, it's even shriveled a bit.
Yeah.
Still looks really sagey and colorful, and it's really neat.
There's an angry little bird yelling at us, which I think is telling us it's time to go. So thanks for listening, everyone. And yeah.
All right, that was fun. For those listeners that have been part of In Defense of Plants for a long enough time, we'll know that those were a lot more frequent style of a podcast that I used to do. It's again, the videos, youtube.com/indefensiveplants have kind of taken the place of these hikes, but why not? We were on a hike, I had my recorder, and it was fun to do. I hope you learned a lot. Big announcement is that this Tuesday, so this is going up on Sunday, but this coming Tuesday, I will be heading down to Costa Rica. Due in part to your help, I'm attending an orchid bee symposium. So there's going to be a lot of incredible interviews and hikes and just tons of botanizing in the rainforests of Costa Rica. So that's one of the big announcements that, again, thanks to those who supported the Patreon and have donated over the last year or so, I've been able to cobble together the funds to make this happen. So stay tuned for all of the wonderful updates. And again, thank you so much for doing this. All right, everyone, until next time, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios.